Welcome to Startup Growth Stories by Arc. Hear from founders of bootstrapped startups and decacorns. We discuss the successes and the failures and the things they learned along the way. In the final minutes, founders get vulnerable. They share how growing their business has impacted their lives. Join us every Thursday for a new startup growth story. And now, here's our host, Don Muir.
Good afternoon, everyone. Today is an extra special episode. I'm joined here with the co-founders of Lendtable, Sheridan and Mitchell. Hey, guys, thank you so much for joining. Appreciate you taking the time. As an overview for those who don't know, Lendtable helps employees secure their financial future by supplying with the funds they need to receive their full 401k match from their employer. Notable clients include the likes of FedEx, AT&T, TechCrunch, Starbucks, Deloitte, and more. Thank you both so much for coming to the podcast with me today.
Thanks so much for having us on.
Let's dive right in. Guys, in three words or less, I want you to describe one another to our audience.
Oh, no.
Let's do it. Well, I think the way I'd describe Mitchell would be caring, passionate, very thoughtful.
Love it.
That's too kind, man.
That's hard to beat.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. No. Not too kind. That would have been five words. I didn't do that.
If I had to describe Sheridan in three words, I think I would choose number one, he's dynamic. Number two, he's visionary. And number three, I think he's very inquisitive. Well, very inquisitive would be two words, so inquisitive. And I think those three things make him a fantastic co-founder and a great partner and great friend.
Love you, brother. I appreciate it.
Love you too, my man.
Sheridan, for those who are not yet familiar with Lendtable, can you just describe what it is that you do for our listeners?
Yeah, in the simplest form, we'll give you money so that you can max out your 401k match and employee benefits. The reason that kind of our company exists is in the US today, 25% of people who have access to a 401k match don't use it. A lot of folks, when they hear that, assume that it's just a lack of education. You know, you get a lot of these people at Walmart, they don't get how their match works, they don't recognize that it's free money, therefore they're not doing it. But really, the broader problem is just a lack of liquidity. The average American doesn't have $500 in their checking account to be able to save up for an emergency expense. So take Mitchell and I's parents as a great example. They understood what their benefits were, but they just didn't have the liquidity to actually take advantage of it. So that's where we step in. We say, you've got access to this $4,000 401k match, but you don't have $4,000 of spare liquidity, and therefore you can't take that out of your paycheck. So we'll give you that money today. You'll put it in your 401k. And then come time when you kind of leave your employer, we'll essentially get 20% of that match, but you're left with the other 80% that you wouldn't have had. So, you know, we like to say that we're kind of pioneering this new category of lend to earn. Our whole goal is to lend you money so that you can earn and get access to all these other employee benefits that you otherwise wouldn't have had.
Incredible. Now, you mentioned your parents. For each of you, what was your inspiration for Lendtable? Like who inspires you? Is there any individual you can point to as your parent or someone else, but who would you say is your biggest inspiration?
Yeah, I think, I mean, for me, so I come from a family of kind of entrepreneurs, but I think much like, you know, a little bit less so the case in kind of Silicon Valley, but much more so the case in just like broader America, I saw firsthand the kind of perpetual trials and tribulations my dad and mom kind of went through. I saw my dad start no less than seven companies and occasionally was doing really well and we were making a bunch of money. And then occasionally we're at points where it's like, oh, like we don't necessarily have a whole lot of money to like buy food on food stamps, I'm going to lose the house. So I think I have a never ending respect for the amount of times my kind of dad built a company, got back up, tried it again. And I think like the silent warrior throughout it all was my mom. My mom always kind of got like dragged into these different startup endeavors. You know, she was always kind of just like, at some point you kind of just got to get a job. But I think, you know, every time she kind of went into it and I saw just like a tremendous amount of grit, like to them putting in 100 hours of work a week was very much so the norm. You'd have to stay up.
Welcome to Startup Growth Stories by Arc. Hear from founders of bootstrapped startups and decacorns. We discuss the successes and the failures and the things they learned along the way. In the final minutes, founders get vulnerable. They share how growing their business has impacted their lives. Join us every Thursday for a new startup growth story. And now, here's our host, Don Muir.
Good afternoon, everyone. Today is an extra special episode. I'm joined here with the co-founders of Lendtable, Sheridan and Mitchell. Hey guys, thank you so much for joining. Appreciate you taking the time. As an overview for those who don't know, LendTable helps employees secure their financial future by supplying with the funds they need to receive their full 401k match from their employer. Notable clients include the likes of FedEx, AT&T, TechCrunch, Starbucks, Deloitte, and more. Thank you both so much for coming to the podcast with me today.
Thanks so much for having us on.
Let's dive right in. Guys, in three words or less, I want you to describe one another to our audience.
Oh, no.
Let's do it. Well, I think the way I describe Mitchell would be caring, passionate, very thoughtful.
Love it.
That's too kind, man.
That's hard to beat.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. No. Not too kind. That would have been five words. I didn't do that.
If I had to describe Sheridan in three words, I think I would choose number one, he's dynamic. Number two, he's visionary. And number three, I think he's very inquisitive. Well, very inquisitive would be two words, so inquisitive. And I think those three things make him a fantastic co-founder and a great partner and great friend.
Love you, brother. I appreciate it.
Love you too, my man.
Sheridan, for those who are not yet familiar with LendTable, can you just describe what it is that you do for our listeners?
Yeah, in the simplest form, we'll give you money so that you can max out your 401k match and employee benefits. The reason that kind of our company exists is in the US today, 25% of people who have access to a 401k match don't use it. A lot of folks, when they hear that, assume that it's just a lack of education. You know, you get a lot of these people at Walmart, they don't get how their match works, they don't recognize that it's free money, therefore they're not doing it. But really, the broader problem is just a lack of liquidity. The average American doesn't have $500 in their checking account to be able to save up for an emergency expense. So take Mitchell and I's parents as a great example. They understood what their benefits were, but they just didn't have the liquidity to actually take advantage of it. So that's where we step in. We say, you've got access to this $4,000 401k match, but you don't have $4,000 of spare liquidity, and therefore you can't take that out of your paycheck. So we'll give you that money today. You'll put it in your 401k. And then come time when you kind of leave your employer, we'll essentially get 20% of that match, but you're left with the other 80% that you wouldn't have had. So, you know, we like to say that we're kind of pioneering this new category of lend to earn. Our whole goal is to lend you money so that you can earn and get access to all these other employee benefits that you otherwise wouldn't have had.
Incredible. Now, you mentioned your parents. For each of you, what was your inspiration for LendTable? Like who inspires you? Is there any individual you can point to with your parents or someone else, but who would you say is your biggest inspiration?
Yeah, I think, I mean, for me, so I come from a family of kind of entrepreneurs, but I think much like, you know, a little bit less so the case in kind of Silicon Valley, but much more so the case in just like broader America, I saw firsthand the kind of perpetual trials and tribulations my dad and mom kind of went through. I saw my dad start no less than seven companies and occasionally was doing really well and we were making a bunch of money. And then occasionally we're at points where it's like, oh, like we don't necessarily have a whole lot of money to like buy food on food stamps. I'm going to lose the house. So I think I have a never ending respect for the amount of times my kind of dad built a company, got back up, tried it again. And I think like the silent warrior throughout it all was my mom. My mom always kind of got like dragged into these different startup endeavors. You know, she was always kind of just like, ah, some point you kind of just got to get a job. But I think, you know, every time she kind of went into it and I saw just like a tremendous amount of grit, like to them putting in 100 hours of work a week was very much so the norm. You'd have to stay up at 2 a.m. doing like embroidery paper and just like, yeah, I mean, the amount of just like blood, sweat, and tears in a literal sense that went into their company, for better or for worse, I think really inspired me and made it so just like the only thing I feel like I could ever do would be an entrepreneur. Very much so for better or for worse.
They sound inspiring. Yeah, for the better or worse. No, that's really great. Mitch, how about you?
Yeah, I'd say inspiration is always it's a funny thing because it comes from so many places. But I think one piece of inspiration comes from observation and one piece of inspiration comes from people. So no doubt about it, when it comes to inspiration for people, it's my family that drives me as well. So my father, similar to Sheridan, my father, different industries though. My father was a builder, right? And he had his own little small building company. The financial crisis with most of construction tanked most of those businesses. And then he reinvented himself over and over and over again with his jobs after that. And my mom is always very similar to Sheridan, has always been the consistent backbone in terms of her work and everything she does as well. And I got to see two things that I really took that were elements to my game, so to speak, in terms of how I work. One is no idea is too big, right? My father is a dreamer. He's always thinking bigger. He's always you know, thinking about an idea. He's always wanting to, I go home and he's shooting ideas at me all the time, right? Even to this day, you know, and that innovation spirit never goes away. And then for my mom, it's just get it done, right? And that's the other thing that I think is a really, really big piece of, you know, how I work on things. And most of the people in the company will tell you, my goal is always just, what do we need to do to get to succeed, right? Like, our goal is to win. We have to help everyone retire by 60, and we're not even close yet. So I think from inspiration point, it's definitely my parents. From an observation standpoint, the big thing that even the only reason I really went into startups was because of the fact that I saw that my parents, when it came time for them to save and invest for retirement, all their money was essentially in checking accounts. And that wasn't because they were stupid. It wasn't because they didn't understand. It was the same thing I saw with all my buddies who lived down the street. It was the same thing I saw with the kids I was going to school with, which is that the access to information in investing is just not very good. And what that means is a lot of people are trying to do, but they don't know. They don't know what they should be doing. And when I saw that, you know, I was in college, right? And I come from Dayton, Ohio. No one's investing. I didn't even know what an investment bank was until I went to Yale. And when I saw that, I just saw such an obvious problem that could be fixed. And it just drove me insane. And I didn't even know anything about startups at that point, but I was like, this specific issue has been pissing me off since effectively now for 10 years. And that was the only reason I went into entrepreneurship to begin with. Didn't know it was going to be that at the time, but I just started using this as research. And to this day, LendTable is just a new derivation of that same problem. So in short, or I guess in long, it's the people in your life and it's the observations you make that really inspire you to do what you're going to do.
Amazing. Yeah. Makes a ton of sense and definitely something that I've noticed throughout my own journey. So that really resonates. So the name of this podcast is Startup Growth Stories. We would like to dig into the founding story, and it's really special that we have both of you in one place. So I want to dig into this founding story behind LendTable. It sounds like Mitch just got into a little bit the tail end of the last question, but it helped me to understand what was the inspiration behind founding this particular idea. How did this idea become a reality, and where did it start? Where was that seed planted?
Yeah, so I think the really cool thing, there's two pieces to this, which is Sheridan's side of it and my side of it, and how it's beautiful.
And I want to hear both.
It's super cool because it's actually how we complement each other as founders as well, which I think is the really cool part about it. So, you know, from my side, I'd been coming from a previous startup, also in financial inclusion. It was called Parable. And what we were trying to build was we were trying to help people save and invest their money. And essentially, your investments are essentially a playbook, right? There's certain things you should do at every step of the way. And everyone advised you on what you should do. We were trying to automate that. We were just trying to do it for you. Real-time payments was starting to get popular. Payroll routing was starting to get popular. A lot of these ideas were getting popular. And I felt that that would be a great way to figure out that exact problem that I had seen for my parents was, you guys, if you just trust a third party, they can automate it for you. And you can probably do it without all these fees, because a lot of this stuff is actually just a technical routing challenge. That being said, the distribution was absolutely a nightmare. And that wasn't the thing we could figure out. So my co-founder and I ended up, I wanted to really double down on the insights we had found in saving and investing. He had seen some really cool insights, specifically in compensation from the employers we had talked to. So he went on to found a compensation company that's doing very, very well. He's doing great. But I was just obsessed with this one specific problem. I want to figure out, how do we help people save and invest? But I needed a new co-founder. So a good buddy of mine introduced me to, as he said, hey, there's this kid working at Dropbox. You know, he's super young, just got out of college. He's interested in startups. Do you want to chat? So I'm coming into this conversation like, all right, like, you know, a mentorship is something I care a ton about. And I like love giving people, especially who are from like different backgrounds, startup advice.
If you were to mentor like someone who's like an emerging middle schooler right now, fundamentally no knowledge of even what the term startup means, you come into that with that mentality, which when you get to know me a little bit better, you recognize it's actually a little bit too advanced for what I'm capable of.
And I think this is actually the perfect dovetail into Sheridan's side of what he had been doing. And then we can kind of get into, how we riffed.
Let's hear it, Sheridan. I want to hear about the initial interactions.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, I think I'll give like a little bit of context on kind of what I had done prior, which kind of, you know, led me to be like a, I guess, 21-year-old at the time doing a 401k company, which is definitely interesting. So I'd kind of like worked in finance when I was 16 and 17, was at JP Morgan and Goldman. So I was really interested in finance from that. But I think I was disinterested in the sense of I felt we were serving a very, very small portion of the population. And it just felt like there was a whole lot of ways you could make people, you know, the 99.9% money. You didn't just have to focus on the 0.01% of kind of the populace. I'd also done a lot of different companies. So first company I did was a hedge fund. We were essentially doing arbitrage, very different kind of space, but we were doing sneakers. So I had bought and sold tens of millions of dollars of sneakers and tickets and apparel by the time I was 18. Afterwards, I'd kind of built like two companies in fintech. One was essentially helping non-accredited investors invest in private equity funds. The other was helping people submit their rental payments to boost their credit, as well as a bunch of different kind of fintech ideas interspersed throughout it. And I think the motivation behind a lot of that was, one, I just, you know, cared very deeply about like helping the communities I came from. But I don't want to make it sound all altruistic. I also just knew, I knew a lot about finance. I really like numbers and math, and I loved arbitrages. I loved it. Like, I just, something about the idea of finding this, like, you know, kind of quick flip always kind of fascinated me. And I think this kind of, you know, segues into how we actually kind of came about LendTable. So I had started at Dropbox. Dropbox was actually the reason kind of Mitchell and I got connected. I was talking with my manager at Dropbox at the time, actually about quitting. This was a month into the company and joining me on kind of startup I was running prior. And he's like, yeah, I hear you. Kind of interesting. Weird thing to do on your first month on the job, but like, here you are.
Right.
But there's this guy, Mitchell, you got to chat with him. He's super, super awesome. So Mitchell and I, you know, we kind of start talking. We initially had slotted like a 30-minute meeting, and you know, Mitch already kind of prefaced it a little bit, 30-minute kind of mentorship meeting, which I am supremely grateful for to this day. No, but I think it ended up turning into this like 5-6 hour long conversation. And initially, it wasn't even about what LendTable is today. It was a bunch of things. You know, Mitch was talking about what he was doing with his company. He had already kind of done, you know, some work and was thinking about ways he can kind of push that forward. I had mentioned the stuff I'd done prior, some of which was still kind of in operation, some of which was talking about it. And then also, like, Mitch had kind of talked about some of the other ideas he had in fintech. And, you know, I had talked about some of the other things that I was kind of thinking on. And I think this kind of goes to that yin and yang that Mitchell was kind of talking about. So, Mitch, got to go for it?
Yeah, I mean, I just really wanted to emphasize, it's like, amen. It's like, that was the piece that was really fun here. It was, you know, me talking about, all right, here's this kind of basic layout with Sheridan. Again, that inquisitive piece just came in, like, tell me what your like model is for how you think about this playbook X, Y, and Z. One of the pieces in it, like anyone who's a finance nerd will know, it's like, step one, pay off super high interest debt. Step two, have 3 to 6 months of high yield savings. Step three in every single playbook is always get your 401k match because it's guaranteed 100% return. And as soon as I said that, you know, and I was, you know, I'm talking about the whole thing, Sheridan just starts on that. He's like, and again, this is where the arbitrage part comes in. He's like, oh my God, I'm saying the same thing at Dropbox. This is crazy. Why are people doing this? This is so wild. I'm like, well, you know, there's all this liquidity stuff. And he's like, yeah, but what if we just bought their 401k off of them? They get the money right up front. And then everyone's happy. And I'm like,
yeah.
And then somebody just clicks in my head. I'm like, well, first of all, Sheridan, that's illegal. But second of all, Sheridan, you're onto something, which is that people have wealth that they're not getting access to today. And that was essentially the crux of what all of LendTable's thesis is, which is that there's $300 billion of benefits that are going unused and unmatched. And essentially, it's a hole in the credit market, and that people aren't recognizing that with a little bit of tech, you can actually help people get this benefit. And I really think that's what really highlights the great balance between Sheridan and I and the beauty of LendTable. It was the no idea is too big, inquisitiveness, and just visionary bit that Sheridan always brings. And then again, that get it done, wait a minute, there's actually something here. Let's double down and let's really start to pull this out. That really got us started. And then from there was, you know, it was months of time of us biking over to Dropbox secretly, hanging out at his house or mine. And that
Sheridan's
was
the boss knew, right? Sheridan's boss knew this meeting happened. He put you guys in ties, right?
He was very supportive of it, just to be clear. Like, he was very, and I think this kind of goes back to even when I was kind of chuckling at that, like, you know, this is like a mentorship meeting for Mitchell. It also, in reality, very much so was. I think it was abundantly clear to me that this man had such an incredible wealth in fintech, such an incredible wealth of knowledge. He'd spent so much of his life and his career building towards it. It was so abundantly clear that this is what genuinely he was like, I don't want to say singularly passionate about, but this was a absolute pillar of what he was trying to do kind of for his life's work. And I think that was incredible to me. Because like, while I may have had the initial thought of like, hey, let's go buy up people's 401ks, I said that amongst a row of six other things I was thinking of. And I think the fact that Mitchell was able to take that and be like, okay, it's interesting idea that you might want to try to make $1 million off of, you know, a Dropbox plan with doing that. But why not? Let's do this across the US. Like, let's make this a national thing. There are an incredible amount of people who have access to it. There's so many ways we can kind of build a scalable organization around it. And I think that was the yin and yang that kind of interplayed so well throughout, I mean, really the entire working relationship that, you know, kind of Mitchell and I have had. So it, I think it very much so was a real mentorship at the end of the day.
From that initial ideation session through, it sounds like months, you know, at Dropbox, working in the dark, working after hours. How did that working relationship evolve between the two of you? And how did the idea go from this initial ideation to what it is today, or to the decision to maybe leave Dropbox and ultimately raise your seed round of capital? I'd love to hear that story, that phase. A lot of first-time founders dialing today, trying to figure out what it takes to quit their job at Dropbox, to leave that guaranteed income, to go do something on their own and take that leap into entrepreneurship.
Yeah. So, I mean, that portion I can talk to very explicitly because I actually created a whole Excel spreadsheet kind of on it. But so initially, I think Mitchell and I probably started talking. I think I was at Dropbox for 2 or 3 months. And then how long was it before that you had kind of, you and your co-founder had split up?
We met in late October. We officially founded the company on March 15th of the next year. So we've October 2019, Sheridan and I met. March 15th, 2020, we founded the company. I was still moonlighting between two companies up until that point. And then so was still working on startup one in the day. And then when Sheridan would get off, we would talk about Parable. So yeah, so that's the pretext there.
Yeah. And I think at that point, I mean, it was very much so kind of interview on both of our behalfs. Like, to be clear, Mitch had far more job opportunities than I did. Like, I had done a Dropbox internship at that point. I dropped out of school. I was at Dropbox for like 2-3 months. So like Mitch was kind of coming by the Dropbox office all the time. We were kind of just like using the cafeteria there and hanging out. And I think a lot of it was one, just like understanding kind of our own working relationship together. I think that's probably one of the biggest things just to start of it matters a lot what we're doing. But I think the reason that I think we both got conviction around it is we fully said, we're like, there are many things that we do not understand about this space. There are many regulatory questions. There are many lending questions. We're going to get confidence and conviction around it by talking to all these lawyers, by testing out this product with other people. It was also an interesting thing of like, not that we thought kind of off the bat that there was product market fit, but there is a clear, we know what the value this can provide is. Like, it is very explicit. These people don't have access to these benefits. We can help them get access to it. So it's less so, can this provide value? But more so, is this a value proposition that people are going to be able to understand, and we're going to be able to do it easily enough, they're going to be able to digest it in such a way that it's going to make sense to kind of sign them up for? Because like the unit economics are very explicit of just like, okay, you don't have a $5,000 match, we're helping you get that $5,000 match. But yeah, I mean, I think the biggest part of the interview process that we're both doing together is just like, could we see ourselves working together kind of for the long haul? And I think I can very proudly say that Mitch is amongst kind of my best friends. And I just could not, like, I would work on the 401k match company with him. I'd work on literally any other startup with him. And I think that was the biggest thing, at least for me, that kind of got me conviction. Oh, and I guess the last thing as to how I actually decided to quit, this one I can talk to kind of specifically. I actually just created an Excel sheet. So I did an Excel sheet of like, what is the expected probabilities of all of these different outcomes? Like, if I stay at this company, what's the chance I get a promotion? I get fired, I plateau. What's like the expected probability of my general states of happiness? How do I feel about joining this new company? And I kind of came to the end conclusion at the end of the day. I was also in a different position because I'd made a couple million kind of from my prior sneaker company. But yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, to me, it was just like, worst case, I hate Mitchell. I hate this company. All of this is terrible. Okay, we just stop working together in 6 months. Mitch has already worked at Dropbox and Facebook. He can get any job he wants. I'm in a slightly trickier spot, but like, worst case, it's like, you know, I'm taking a job while making half the pay, which is still fine to me. But I won't regret having, you know, kind of made that decision and trying it. So to me, the Excel sheet lined up such that there was legitimately no downside of quitting. Like, I just felt like there was so many fallbacks. And if I compare that to like my parents, it was very different. Like, to them, doing a startup was like taking out a second mortgage on the house. You know, my dad didn't graduate from college. Like, there was real risk. And to me, it was just like, this isn't a risky proposition at all.
Right. It's almost a no-brainer when you look at it in hindsight. And Mitchell, how about you? I mean, it sounds like you had plenty of opportunity. It sounds like there's lots of, you know, co-founders, including other startup you were working on. How did you decide that Sheridan was the one that this was the opportunity that you wanted to go heads down and just run at? Is there an aha moment for you where you said, hey, there's a real opportunity here. I'm doing this thing. And Sheridan's the guy I'm doing it with.
So there's a couple elements to that question. One, I self-funded my startup journey. So one of the things that was taught, and I don't come from money. So a lot of people, you know, will ask like, you know, Mitch, you decided to work in industry. I worked in industry because I needed money, right? But I also built a lot of skills, right? So I worked at Dropbox. Then I worked at Facebook where I was running a fintech wallet. It was essentially a precursor to Libra. It was called Mobile Financial Services. And I was running that product for all of Latin America and Asia Pacific. So I learned a bunch about how to, you know, build, run teams in addition to obviously saving money. But the really important thing is when you are using your own money to finance your startup ambitions, you have to get really efficient with the little bit of runway you have. So when my original co-founder and I split up, you know, I had a choice. I had three things I had to figure out. I knew I wanted another co-founder and I knew I wanted someone to work with. Number two, I could have continued building the product. Or number three, I could have continued trying to get original customers because we were going B2B to C or business to business then into a consumer. I chose find a good co-founder you want to work with. And the reason why was one, I knew fundamentally that for my style, I needed somebody that I could work with to build something really big. Number two is I didn't fully believe I had found the right thing from a product perspective. So I was willing to shuffle the deck on that perspective. Secondly, and this is actually one of the things that was really, really important about Sheridan that made me feel confident about working with him, right? And then I can also talk about LendTable itself, right? Because there's two reasons that I had to do. I had to both be comfortable to shut down the old business, but also work with, who did I want to work with? So from the product perspective, I love to think about what needs to be true for a business to be big, and does the idea just make sense? And at its core, LendTable aligns a lot of parties, right? People are getting squeezed. Record keepers are missing out on more assets under management. There's just so much alignment. And also, it solves a lot of the challenges of consumer fintech, which is usually it's hard to make money and also scale because the customer acquisition cost is too high. LendTable did both of those very well. So I felt like this was a potential home run hit idea, number one. So that was made me feel confident about LendTable. But more importantly, I had to feel confident about Sheridan. I think there's two things that I would, anyone who's listening to this who's a first-time founder, make sure the person you are working with, you understand their incentives and that their core incentive is they just want to win. They don't care about the titles. They don't care about the who's doing what. Like, we want to make something really big, right? That is most teams and most startups fail because the founders, either they can't raise money or the founders split up and they can't get big, right? And don't let problems that maybe will be problems down the road be problems now when they don't need to. The other one, which was really, really valuable, is Sheridan and I in the early days had things that we disagreed on, but we always found ways to resolve our disagreements in aspect of what we felt was best for the business. And those two things are super important because you will disagree. Some will be some fights. Some won't be some fights. But at the end of the day, do you still respect the person you're sitting across from the table? And do you still believe they believe in this business and they want it? It's going to be a $1 billion business. And I think those were the things I saw in Sheridan from the beginning, where it's like, I think he's brilliant. I think there's so much that he already brings to the table. He just gets it. He's so creative. But more importantly, I trust him. And I trust that we will be able to disagree and we will still continue growing this business. And that is one of the things where if you don't, like anybody listening to this, if you do not feel that in your heart about your co-founder, I don't think you should work with him.
And I think even to second that last point, like that whole kind of idea of like, there's some strong disagreement. At some point, you're going to have to go with what the other person says, whether it's your opinion and the other person's, you know, not getting their way or the other person's getting their way. The ability to move on from that is so huge. I've seen some founders where it's like that happens. They never get over it. No, I mean, there's absolutely been decisions where it's like, I've disagreed with Mitch. We've just, you know, for whatever reason, kind of decided that going with Mitch is kind of what we should do, probably just because he's right most of the time. And I get over it. At the end of the day, it is a business decision that is important. There is absolutely no business benefit of lingering on it. I think that is a huge, huge thing. And I absolutely saw that in Mitchell. So I couldn't second any more of what he just said.
Those are such insightful points. And I would encourage, you know, first-time founders to rewind, go back and listen to this narrative right here. I wish I could have, you know, listened to this a year and a half ago. I mean, all of this resonates with me and rings true for me and my co-founding team. So very well said, guys. Let's fast forward a little bit. Let's talk about fundraising. A lot of the founders listening in today want to raise capital, have raised capital, considering their first price round. Can you talk a little about your fundraising journey? I guess first, the decision to raise seed capital. And then I know you recently raised a Series A financing as well. So congrats on all the success, raising literally tens of millions of dollars of capital. What does that feel like? Why did you decide to sell a portion of your equity to fund your growth? And then if you just compare seed fundraising to Series A price fundraising, that would be really helpful for the listeners dialed in today.
Yeah. So Mitch, mind if I take kind of why we raised? This actually, we'll get back to.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. So to that point I was just making, Mitch is right kind of most of the time. This is actually a great example of where we did have an argument. So I was like, why would we raise money for this? This is a cash cow. Like, we're making very, you know, guaranteed returns. Like, why would we want to bring on outside capital? Mitch had a difference of opinion on it. I think eventually we ended up coming to the decision that it makes sense to raise. That was absolutely the correct choice. I think our goal was to build a multi-billion dollar, gigantic, generational company. And to do that, there's a lot of things we're cognizant of. One, just like having more capital enables us to bring on a team, to bring on all these other people. We're also fundamentally at its core a very capital intensive business. And even worse so, you know, if you look at the cash flow for it, we're deploying large amounts of money right now and we're getting that money back in the future, which means that if we're going to grow 10x in a year, you can't even do that with cash that you have on hand. You either need to do it with debt or equity. Like, you just have to. If not, then you're, you know, essentially capped at growing at whatever is like the fixed interest rate that you're kind of charging, which is not what we wanted to be capped by and constrained by. So I mean, I think the first round that we put together, I think it's very important to talk about the actual like time in the market of which we did it, because it can heavily dictate what your fundraising process is like. We started this company in March of 2020. For those of you who don't remember, that was the beginning of COVID. On top of that, a bunch of companies, you know, we were getting news articles from helpful investors all the time being like, hey, just saw this article talking about this company removing their 401k match. Is that an issue for you guys? We're like, ah, great. Like, that's some great sentiment. So it was a absolute like slugfest to do it. We ended up bringing on what must have been 60 to 70 people from our cap table and just trying to talk to as many angels, as many people who'd be willing to pick up the phone with us as possible. And from that, we put together about $1 million.
Purely angel investors, $1 million of angel.
A lot of angel funds. We also had a couple like actual funds. So like Foundation Capital was the first kind of like serious fund that kind of backed us, which we were super, super excited for. The next round that we kind of went through was YC. So we got into YC, we went through that. At the tail end of YC, we ended up raising our seed round. And that was a very kind of different experience to what we initially had. Couple of reasons. One, the market had certainly just gotten better. Like, there was less for about 2-3 months during that COVID era. Everyone was worried that like, it was going to be the absolute implosion of the markets. Everything was going to fall off a cliff. All of these kind of fundraising rounds and all.
Which batch was this, Sheridan?
Summer 20.
Summer 20. Okay, got it.
Yeah. So that was a much, much quicker process. You know, we ended up having kind of fewer conversations, ended up bringing on kind of a handful of funds we were kind of super excited about. And then most recently, we kind of did our Series A. And that Series A, it was an even more kind of different experience. We went from being, you know, in our first round, okay, we're trying to talk to anyone possible to kind of put this together, to, okay, we have 6 term sheets on the table. We can only go with one of these term sheets. We're going to have to figure out kind of what we're actually going to do here.
I'd love to understand how you choose. First of all, great problem to have. How do you select your investor among 6 competing term sheets? Is it always price? Does investor matter? Can you just talk other terms, non-financial terms? Like, how do you actually wrap your head around 6 term sheets when you're lucky enough to be in that position?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, well, first of all, we can answer one thing is for us at least, and again, one of the things you all will see is that fundraising is an art, not a science. And again, a lot of it is you and your founding team thinking about what's best for your business. So for our Series A, you know, of these 6 term sheets, price was important, but it actually wasn't the most important factor. We actually didn't go with the term sheet that just gave us the highest valuation. And the reason why is we loved our Series A lead. So we did our lead from O1 Advisors, the fund started by Dick Costolo and Adam Bain, the former CEO and COO of Twitter. And what we loved about them is they were they're just operators through and through, right? They get on the phone with us whenever. I mean, I just texted Adam the other day for things we wanted for, again, for raising debt, because obviously we have a capital intensive business, as Sheridan talked about. Those guys are hopping on the phone whenever we need them. And at the end of the day, they've been there, they've done that before, and they just get it. And for us, given the fact that we are in a new market and we're the category leader in a new market, we felt that having that type of experience was really valuable for us. And every term sheet's not one size fits all. And you really want to make sure as you continue to grow that you have people around the table who you think are adding something to your game, right? Or adding something to your team. Every investor is a teammate. And when you think about them like a teammate, you should be evaluating them on more than just the dollars they're bringing in. One of the things I will say though, and Sheridan, you might have thoughts as well. I think this calculus changes depending on the market, depending on the fundraise, right? So in our earliest days, your number one job is don't run out of money, right? And frankly, you have to think about investor dynamics. In the earliest days, once an investor writes a check at seed and pre-seed, you're pretty much out of their head, right? Because they have to deploy so many more checks. And also at the same point in time, for them to return the fund, you're not going to return the fund for years, right? So, and also they have other fund or other startups that are already further along. And then for them, they're trying to help those startups get even deeper in the process, because again, that's doubling down for them. So from that perspective, the amount of help you will get from the avid investor looks different at the seed level than it does at the Series A, and then again at the Series B, and so on. So in the earliest of days, our number one job was make sure we raise enough money that we'll be able to continue surviving. Your number one job as a founder is don't let your company run out of money. Don't let your company die. And the next step for us was then saying, you know, as we continue to grow this, make sure we're being efficient with our capital to prove the narrative. At your seed round, most of what you're selling is the vision and the team. That's the thing that's going to, because we're going only home run hits here. So you have to explain why you have a big market, a big vision, and the best team out there. When you get to Series A, you should start to be able to show you have a thesis that actually is repeatable, right? So it's not like tons of unit economics are really going to be the driver yet. For some businesses, it might, depending on the industry. But at that point, it's, do you have something that's repeatable? Do you have a very clear thesis? And then can you actually show that that thesis has an opportunity to grow? So really, really important for kind of two things. One, investors matter a ton because they can change the narrative for you, especially as you get further along in the business. But number two, at the earliest stages, it's a little bit of a different dynamic.
Yeah, very, very well said. And fundamentals, as you get, you know, further and further along, become increasingly important. In the beginning, it's all about vision. It's all about the founding team. And clearly, you guys have something very special going on here. Look, in the last segment of this podcast, we like to get a little bit vulnerable with founders. I appreciate that starting a company is hard. And many of the guests we've had on our podcast have shared the challenges, the trials and tribulations of actually starting a company and the toll it can take on your physical and mental health. I'd like to understand what keeps you both up at night and how you actually cope with the daily stresses of starting a company, sharing that back with our listeners to actually help them manage the pressures of building and scaling a technology business.
I think on my end, one thing I was definitely, so I've done a lot of startups before. This is the first time I have a large team and an office and a lot of full-time employees. And I kind of had this expectation that when I had this kind of big team, all these pressures and stresses would kind of get taken away from me. It's great. I got all these people who are now kind of managing these things and like fewer things I need to think about. And in reality, it's almost the opposite. Now there's like so many more, you know, things that can come up, so many more things that are kind of on your mind. You know, there's like people's livelihoods and, you know, employees have kids and they have families. And, you know, you really, I think it is incredibly meaningful that like they've taken a bet on us at this early stage. They've really shown conviction that they care about what our journey is. And it would feel very bad to, you know, now it's not even like, you know, Mitchell and I letting each other down. It's like we're letting down this like broader group of people and all the investors and all the other people who are that have been helpful and have been advisors and all those things. I think with that being said, like one of the biggest thing that kind of helps me kind of manage the stress is I have been in positions where I felt no stress. Like when I was at Dropbox, when I've worked on other projects, and every single time that has been a recipe for a very, very bad mental health state for me. So I think a lot of people kind of say negative things on stress to some degree. And I think a lot of the times it can be a very positive emotional state to be in because it's a driving force behind action. And if anything, I don't know if I want to be in an environment where there's no stress. I mean, actually, I know for certain, I do not want to be in an environment where there is no stress. So, you know, whenever it gets like a little bit overwhelming or anything like that, I balance that with, okay, I mean, I could just be like working at a job where I'm doing like 10, 20 hours a week and fine. And I know the absolute pit of dismay and despair that puts me in. No, this doesn't seem so bad.
Right. You think to yourself, what's the alternative? And realize that you thrive in this environment and this is the best position for you to be in.
I need a little bit of chaos. A ton of sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Mitchell?
I think and this is probably something that a lot of founders will understand because it happens at every single stage of your business. The scaling challenge always feels like it's daunting, right? When you raise a new round, you're super excited about it. Then you look at it and you're like, oh my God, to get to the next round, the amount of stuff I have to do seems wild. Or when you're in a pre-seed, oh my God, just getting a customer seems so hard. Like it's the scaling problem. You're always thinking about it. And, you know, spoiler alert, it doesn't go away, but you get better at managing it. And the thing I would say is that's the thing that always is you know, what I'm thinking about is how do we level up our game, right? Like, what are the new tools in the tool belts we're going to add, right? So if last year we worked on our free throw, now we're working on our three pointers, right? So how are we continuing to up what we're doing? And I think the best suggestion I have for people is you have to be able to combine two skills really well. You have to be able to maintain your vision of knowing where you're going, but you have to obsess over just win the day ahead of you, right? Greatness is iterative. Greatness is what you're doing every day. It's choosing every single day to do to your best damn ability the most important thing you can be doing that day and know exactly what that is, right? You don't get to a round overnight, but every single day, there's something that is the most important thing you could be doing to get to that next place and getting really, really good at only focusing on that thing. Because if you focus on everything else, it's going to feel daunting. You're going to be looking at the mountain. You're going to be like, how am I going to get that up? All you need to worry about is, can you take the step in front of you today? And I think that has been, for me, really, really important is I very much know, and Sheridan does too, what we have to do. And that scale always looks scary, right? But then you work your way back and say, what are the most important things I could be doing? And only focus on that. And when you do that, a lot of times, that problem doesn't feel as like make you feel so anxiety driving or stressful because you're breaking it down into smaller parts that are things you can win. So focus on the steps ahead of you. Be great in the day that you have. Win the day in front of you would be my suggestion to people.
Very, very well said. Break it down. Win the battle each day and you'll win. Absolutely. You'll win the war.
Last thing on how to manage stress. Have a kick-ass co-founder like Mitchell. Makes it a lot easier.
Amen.
Exactly. I think that's the biggest takeaway from this podcast episode, guys. You've built an incredible company. It's clear to me why and how. I know it's clear to the listeners on this podcast. Thank you both so much for joining me today and helping startups grow. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Startup Growth Stories. To continue the discussion, head over to arc.tech.